One man took on Monsanto and won.
I really wanted to tell this story. My first book was very scientific, nerdy, maybe very, academic. And this book, I wanted it to really just resonate with everybody, with the general readers. Just I wanted it to be the truly dramatic story that it was, as I watched this case unfold. And I wanted people to feel like they knew this very special man, Lee Johnson, who was the very first person in the world to end up taking Monsanto to court, to trial. Lee's a, average guy, pulled himself up by the bootstraps, had a hard childhood, didn't really know his dad, didn't graduate college, really struggled, but got himself together kind of in middle age, married two little boys of his own, working a good job as a school groundskeeper, spraying chemicals, glyphosate-based Roundup, another Ranger Pro, another herbicides around schools, and really trying to do his job well and make sure that he was there to be a really good role model and influence for his kids. And then he experiences in the book, you follow him to work and you are with him on the day that he suffers this really tragic accident in which there's a malfunction with the tank sprayer of the weed killer. And he gets just doused, head to toe and soaked in this pesticide. And then, over the months and that follow that, he develops a lesion and then more. And then ultimately he's diagnosed with terminal non-Hodgkin lymphoma and, told essentially he's not going to be there for his boys. He's not going to see them grow up.
That's Carrie Gillam. Her last book about Monsanto was Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. Now she's back with a page-turning follow-up. The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice. Then, sea level rise is happening, and it's affecting way more than just coastal communities. That means millions are going to have to move to higher ground.
Global sea level has changed up and down hundreds of feet over geologic history, including over the last 10 or 20,000 years. There's two things that are different about this time. One is that we've been fooled because for the last 6,000 years, sea level's been pretty stable. And the reason is because we'd left the 20,000 year roughly period of sea level rising as the planet naturally warmed from the last ice age, and almost certainly would have been entering the 80,000 year cooling period. We are now in a super warming period because, as you and your listeners know, climate change is quite real. The planet's warmer, ice is melting, weather patterns are changing. And so we're in this new super warming era that really is without precedent in human civilization.
That's John Englander. We talk with him about how fast sea level rise is happening and what communities can do about it. His book is Moving to Higher Ground. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Glyphosate, commonly known as Roundup, is the world's most widely used herbicide. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, or IARC, says it's a probable human carcinogen. Other scientific studies have linked it not only to cancer, but to kidney and liver damage, endocrine disruption, reproductive harm and birth defects, neurological damage, and immune system dysfunction. It doesn't just poison people, but the insects that pollinate our food crops and other living beings. But aggressive public relations by glyphosate's developer, Monsanto, and its current purveyor, Bayer, has resulted in the widespread perception that glyphosate is safe. So it's no surprise that school groundskeeper Lee Johnson thought Roundup was safe, but two tragic accidental spills of the chemical left him with a horribly disfiguring and deadly disease. In a groundbreaking case with global implications, Johnson took Monsanto to court and won. We last spoke with journalist Carrie Gillum about her expose of how Monsanto had captured federal agencies and academic scientists to promote glyphosate and suppress attempts to regulate it. Now she's come out with the thrilling courtroom drama of Lee Johnson's suit against Monsanto. It's called The Monsanto Papers. Carrie Gillum, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
We last spoke with you, I believe it was in 2017, about your book Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. And congratulations, it won the 2018 Rachel Carson Book Award. That's terrific.
Thank you. Yeah, that meant a lot to me.
So this book, The Monsanto Papers, is a follow-up to that story. It's a kind of true crime story, corporate crime, and courtroom drama. You tell it thrillingly. It tells the inside story of a man named Lee Johnson, his 2018 lawsuit and trial against Monsanto. But before we get to the story of Mr. Johnson and his case, I'd like to talk a little bit about Monsanto itself. And, you know, what I was surprised, I think I probably knew this, but I hadn't put it together the way you did in this book. Monsanto's responsible not just for the toxic substance glyphosate, which is in Roundup, but it's produced the all-star lineup of deadly chemicals, PCB, DDT, Agent Orange. I'd just like to ask you, what is the business model that makes Monsanto, or made it, the killer company that it is? And that's not a metaphor.
Well, of course, Monsanto is not alone, you know, in, I guess, peddling products and substances and chemicals that we now understand are, you know, so dangerous and have done so much damage to the environment, to human health. You know, this was sort of what we saw in the rise of industrialization and these industrial chemicals, and then a turn to using these chemicals more in agriculture. You know, all of this transpired over the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And of course, Rachel Carson wrote in her book Silent Spring and other works about the dangers of the rise of the use of very dangerous chemicals in our world, and what that would mean for health, not only for birds and insect species, but for us people, you know, and she was right. And sadly, you know, I think the lessons that we learned or should have learned from Rachel Carson, you know, we seem to have forgotten those, because we are in a new age of seemingly pushing more and more pesticides, particularly into agriculture and food production.
Yes, and it's really terrifying. So now tell us a little bit about glyphosate itself, what it does to the human body generally, because what it did to Mr. Lee Johnson was really, really shocking. And I'll ask you about that in a little bit later. But tell us the impact of glyphosate. What are we learning about it?
So glyphosate, Monsanto introduced glyphosate and patented this as a weed-killing chemical in 1974. And Monsanto has always maintained that it's much safer than other weed-killing chemicals that are on the market or have been on the market for many, many years. And they were able to really, you know, multiply the use of this chemical when they introduced genetically engineered crops in the 1990s that were altered, had their DNA altered so that they could withstand being sprayed with glyphosate weed-killing chemicals. And the weeds in the field would die, but then the crops would not. It was the way that this system worked, or does still work. And that really just profoundly increased the use of glyphosate chemicals. In the 90s, for example, there was about 124 million pounds of glyphosate being used around the world. That figure is now close to 2 billion pounds a year. And so this is the most widely used weed killer in the world. It's ubiquitous. It's found in rain and air samples and soil and you know, water. It's in the food that we eat. And it's found very commonly in human urine samples. If you have your urine tested for this chemical, you'll find weed killer in your own body. So, you know, Monsanto was very successful in pushing this to just extraordinary levels of use.
And, you know, part of the business model that does this is regulatory capture. In your last book, you spoke about that in more detail, you know, how the EPA had been captured, and it's only gotten worse. What did get worse under Trump? If it could get worse, I hope it will get better. So where has that left those people who have been so severely affected by glyphosate?
Yeah, so over the years, as glyphosate rose to prominence as such a widely used chemical, more and more scientists started looking at the human and environmental impacts. And that's where we saw this development of research showing that indeed it could be cancer-causing and cause non-Hodgkin lymphoma and an array of other health problems in people, and then many, many different environmental harms as well. So, you know, regulators, sadly, in Europe and the U.S. and many other countries have not really recognized the evidence of cancer and health problems. They have sort of stuck to the Monsanto narrative that, you know, this doesn't cause cancer. We don't need to worry about it. They rely pretty heavily on science that was generated by Monsanto and other companies that sell glyphosate products. So there is no official cancer warning on any of these products, though the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is part of the World Health Organization, has classified it officially as a probable human carcinogen with a tie to non-Hodgkin lymphoma specifically.
And has any substance that's been so classified as a probable human carcinogen ever be found to be completely benign?
Oh, not that I am familiar with, no. These are the expert cancer scientists, some of the most prominent and well-respected scientists in the world who made this determination. And they looked at years of epidemiology and toxicology and genotoxicity. And, you know, in fact, what we're seeing is more evidence of cancer causation, not less, as the research continues to develop.
Right. And now tell us about Mr. Lee Johnson. It turned into a landmark case, but it's a shocking case. Tell us about him and what happened to him.
Yeah, I really wanted to tell this story. My first book was very scientific, nerdy, maybe very, you know, academic. And this book, I wanted it to really just resonate with everybody, with the general readers. Just I wanted it to be the truly dramatic story that it was, you know, as I watched this case unfold. And I wanted people to feel like they knew this very special man, Lee Johnson, who was the very first person in the world to end up taking Monsanto to court, to trial. Lee's a, you know, average guy, pulled himself up by the bootstraps, had a hard childhood, didn't really know his dad, didn't graduate college, really struggled, but got himself together kind of in middle age, was married, two little boys of his own, working a good job as a school groundskeeper, spraying chemicals, glyphosate-based Roundup, another Ranger Pro, another herbicides around schools, and really trying to do his job well and make sure that he was there to be a really good role model and influence for his kids. And then he experiences in the book, you follow him to work and you know, are with him on the day that he suffers this really tragic accident in which there's a malfunction with the tank sprayer of the weed killer. And he gets just doused, you know, head to toe and soaked in this pesticide. And then, you know, over the months and that follow that, you know, he develops a lesion and then more and then more. And then ultimately he's diagnosed with terminal non-Hodgkin lymphoma and, you know, told essentially he's not going to be there for his boys. He's not going to see them grow up.
And when you say a lesion, describe that. What do you mean?
Oh, Lord. I mean, some of them look like if someone put a cigar out on your body, you know, just round, deep holes. I mean, just wounds that weep and bleed and ooze and sometimes get infected, eruptions, and then they scar over. You know, I mean, it's horrific to actually look at the devastation. This is a type of non-Hodgkin lymphoma that manifests in the skin. There are many different types of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. This is mycosis fungoides, which affects the tissues, the skin tissue. And it looks like he's, I think I described in the book, like he's been burned in a war, you know, that he never signed up to fight. Like he just, at one point looking at the wounds on his body when I was interviewing him, you know, I had to cry. I couldn't bear that someone was suffering the way that he has suffered.
And he was really disfigured.
Very, yeah. It's just profoundly sad and tragic what he's been going through.
He's a remarkable person, and he was a careful person. I mean, he was careful about health and safety, unlike a whole lot of other people. You know, he took precautions, but as you said, this was an accident, and it wasn't the only one.
Right. He, after the first accident, and he, you know, starts to get these lesions, and he's seen a doctor, and he's trying to be treated, and they think that maybe it's the type of a skin cancer. They're not, you know, he calls Monsanto, actually. He's been doing some research and sees that there's some concern about glyphosate and cancer, and calls Monsanto and gets to talk to somebody there and expresses his concern, says he's, you know, really wants to know if this could be causing cancer, because if it is, he wants to stop doing his job. He should stop spraying this chemical. He doesn't want to make it worse. But they don't call him back. And we see in internal emails that I show in the book, you know, that Monsanto talked about his situation and they talked about his call internally. But they elected not to call him back, not to warn him, not to give him any information. And he just kept spraying until another accident pushed him over the edge and pushed him into a terminal situation.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist and author Carrie Gillum about her book, The Monsanto Papers. It's a follow-up from her first book, Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. And this one follows the story of Lee Johnson, a landmark case that was brought against Monsanto for the damages that the weed killer glyphosate had visited upon Mr. Johnson, devastating ones with a fatal disease. Now, he does find a lawyer. Actually, you follow other characters in the book, like the attorneys. For example, Mike Miller, the lead attorney on this, he went into action, in fact, when the IARC found glyphosate to be a probable human carcinogen, as we spoke about before. Tell us a little bit about Mike Miller and how did they get in touch with each other?
Sure. So, yeah, Mike Miller is the patriarch, the founder of a law firm in Virginia, in a little teeny tiny town called Orange, Virginia. And he is, you know, just quite a character. He's a good old Southern gentleman, and he's tried lots of very, very big cases, never against a chemical company, an agrochemical company like Monsanto. Always really, he specialized in sort of pharmaceutical and medical device work and that sort of thing. But, you know, very good at what he did in terms of bringing cases against very powerful companies that injured people. So after this cancer decision, classification by this international scientific body, he started doing research and filed initial litigation against Monsanto so that he could start discovery, which is the process of getting court-ordered documents from inside the company. And Monsanto, you know, wasn't too fearful. You're there in the book, you're there in that meeting where he first sat down with Monsanto's lawyers, and they said, sure, we'll give you whatever you want. We don't have anything to hide. Don't worry about it. And they ultimately turn over about, you know, a little more than 10 million documents that Mike Miller's firm gets to go through. And so you go through that process and are with him as they are sitting in this little law firm in Virginia, pulling these documents and finding what they term as gold, pure gold. And they know they've got a good case. And then they're advertising, and Lee Johnson finds them because they're advertising for clients, people who have been hurt or injured by their use of Roundup or glyphosate products.
So what made it such a good case? And do you have any idea, was Monsanto just unaware of what they were giving, or was it just the arrogance of power?
You know, if you talk to the lawyers, and the story, again, is very much told through Lee Johnson's eyes and then the eyes of this team of lawyers, they thought it was hubris, just sheer arrogance, that is what they will tell you, is what they've told me, that these lawyers and this company had always won the day, had always gotten away with, you know, whatever they needed to do to keep this product rolling, and were usually quite successful in court in terms of any sort of challenges to them on any of their products. So the takeaway from the lawyers was just that they didn't think they could be beaten.
Hmm. And so what made it such a good case?
Oh, my Lord. Well, again, there's so many dramatic twists and turns. So from that standpoint, as I was watching this case and reporting on it and traveling around the country and sort of following the lawyers and getting to know Lee's family and Lee's situation, there were lots of things that happened. You know, there's a tragic accident just on the eve of trial. Another lawyer gets, in a lot of trouble, someone Lee was pretty close to, and goes down a dark path. There are divorces, there's financial stress. So there's a lot of dramatic elements to it that I think make it a really good story. And of course, it reveals through these documents that these lawyers find and the evidence that they present, there are a lot of revelations that are important for public policy and just, you know, public understanding of how corporations like Monsanto can manipulate science, can manipulate regulators, can deceive consumers, and really push these harmful products into the marketplace where they're used for decades. So I think it's also emblematic and sort of a warning tale of what happens in many other sort of industries and sectors of our society.
Could you just give us a couple of examples of what you mean by that? You know, the ways that they operate to manipulate, say, the regulators, you know, which they certainly did in this case.
Yeah, so one of the things that we found out, and part of the drama of the whole story, is how these lawyers were able to bring these documents that they got through discovery into public light so that we could all see them and learn about them. Because Monsanto, of course, once they turned them over and realized, oh my goodness, we've revealed a lot of secrets here, they tried to keep them sealed. And how those documents became unsealed and thrust into the public light just past midnight one summer evening, you know, is sort of dramatic in and of itself. But we learned, for instance, that an arm of the Health and Human Services Department wanted to take an independent look at this chemical in 2015, about the same time these international cancer scientists were doing that. And they wanted to look at the toxicity and cancer questions, and Monsanto didn't want them to do that. And they were very worried about it. And they talk internally about the concern that they have about this agency looking hard at the science around their chemical. So they enlist the help of EPA officials to quash this investigation by this other agency. And to see the conversations and the text messages and the emails that go back and forth, and you see EPA officials jumping to help them, rushing, saying, yeah, we're on it. And one official saying, you know, I'll do my best. If I can kill this, I should get a medal. Because it's going to be really hard to get this other agency not to do this work. And you see all that unfold. And there's just example after example after example of that sort of behind the scenes manipulation that goes on. This is just outrageous.
And was this during a Republican administration or a Democratic one?
Well, I have to say, the manipulations have gone on throughout, you know, for decades now. I mean, we have problems in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, so this would have been 2015. So where were we? We were still with Obama then, weren't we? Yeah. So
it's a bipartisan regulatory capture.
It definitely is. Yes.
So now Johnson won his case, but he's still waiting for justice. Tell us what's going on, what's happening, and what does that say about the courts being the remedy for justice for people who are victims of these companies?
Well, actually, Lee did finally get paid just right after my book went to print. So if we get a reprint here, we'll have to update that. But the company appealed. He did win. He won $289 million from a jury that was outraged at the deception and the weight of the scientific evidence, and then the weight of the deception, the evidence of deception and manipulation. $289 million. Appellate judges reduced that pretty significantly. Monsanto kept appealing. There's a provision in California that is sort of odd, but if someone is expected to die very soon, they are not usually entitled to as much money in a lawsuit payout, because they're not expected to be suffering for long. They're not expected to have, you know, medical bills that continue. So because he had a very short life expectancy, his amount of money that he was awarded was cut very dramatically through the appeals process. So his ultimate went from $289 to $20.5 million. And after losing all of their appeals, Monsanto finally paid him in last fall.
It's really terrible. I mean, if somebody dies early, that leaves his family bereft for longer.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, yes, if he had been expected to live another 20 years, you know, the award would have been allowed to be higher, perhaps. But because of his short life expectancy, we should note, though, that Lee Johnson has outlived what the doctors have said. His own doctors told him he had 18 months to live. Monsanto's doctors argued that he had maybe 24. And, you know, it's been past that now, and he's still out there living and hanging on. And he's, you know, kind of goes up and down, and some days he feels all right, and other days he just feels terrible, but he's hanging in there.
Yes, a very brave soul also. Tell us a little bit about your personal experience of him.
Getting to know Lee was really, I feel like it's the perfect example of, you know, peeling back the layers on an onion, I guess, or whatever that phrase is. He's hard to get to know, I think, at the beginning. He's got some walls up around him. He's had a really hard time and, you know, been in the spotlight, which is not something that he necessarily relished. He treasures his privacy. He treasured his health. He treasures his boys, you know, his family. And it's really been very emotionally, you know, just hard for him, as well as physically, you know, hard. But once you get inside and you get him to trust you and talk to you, he's just such an incredible and lovely individual, and very creative. He's artistic. He makes music. He paints. He draws. He writes. And he has some really, you know, profound views about the world and, you know, how we should all care for each other and do well as best we can and raise our children right. And, you know, he's a special person. And I feel honored that I have been able to spend, you know, quite a bit of time with him.
And now, what is the significance of this win? You know, is it changing anything? In fact, Monsanto was bought by Bayer. So what's happening going forward here in terms of the deployment of this chemical and redress for people who've been injured by it?
So it is true, Bayer, the giant pharmaceutical company based in Germany, bought Monsanto in June of 2018, just as the Lee Johnson trial was beginning, which was incredibly bad timing on their part. They paid about $63 billion for Monsanto. And by August of that year, when the jury verdict came down in favor of Johnson, their market capitalization plunged about 40%. Investors became outraged, and two subsequent trials that they also lost just put investors up in arms. They are furious still to this day that this company spent all this money on Monsanto. They are now trying to settle the litigation. There's about 100,000 plaintiffs like Lee Johnson who've sued in the U.S., and the Bayer has said it will pay $11 billion to settle as many of those as it can. They're trying to put out another $2 billion or so to head off future litigation and pay people who've been exposed but maybe haven't sued yet. And they're just really struggling to try to figure out how to get out from under this huge weight of this litigation. At the same time, there's class action in Australia that is going forward, and Mexico is looking to ban glyphosate. Thailand tried to ban glyphosate. France, Italy, Germany, other countries are looking to ban it now. New York State is moving to ban it. You know, it's been a very impactful litigation, and Lee Johnson's case was, you know, what got it all rolling, really.
Well, that's great. Now, you are the research director. You used to work for Reuters, but you're the research director for a nonprofit organization called U.S. Right to Know. Tell us about that organization and its link to your journalism.
So I spent, 17 years at Reuters, which is this big international news agency, and that's where I covered agriculture and Monsanto and got to really, learn all that has informed my books and my work. Joined U.S. Right to Know in 2016. It's a little tiny nonprofit, and really all we do is investigative research or investigative journalism, I guess you would say. We file Freedom of Information Act requests with federal agencies and state record requests with universities and state agencies, and just are in the business of trying to gather documents and data that pertain to public and environmental health, on pesticides and other health related issues, and then share that information with other journalists or lawyers or lawmakers or consumers, policymakers, just trying to be a one-stop shop for people who don't have the time and resources and tenacity to fight for, government documents that are important. I've had to sue the EPA twice. I've sued the FDA once to get documents that they should turn over. That I think these agencies forget they're public agencies. They're supposed to work for, the public good, and they need to be reminded of that. And so that's what we do at U.S. Right to Know.
Do you have any opinion on the new heads of EPA and FDA? Do you think that things might get better going forward?
I'm cynical, but I don't want to be. So I think Biden's administration is talking a good game right now so far. They're saying they want to restore scientific integrity. They want to relook at sort of decisions and positions on chemicals like glyphosate and other pesticides and other chemical substances where the science is showing us we really should be reining them in. The Trump administration sort of opened the barn door and just said, here you go, chemical companies, whatever you want, you got. Biden's administration has said that they're going to try to, get a handle on things again. So I don't know. I'm skeptical, cynical, but I have hope.
Well, that's great. And people who read your book, The Monsanto Papers, Carrie Gillam, can get informed so that they may be able to add their voices to making sure the EPA and the FDA protect the American public.
Exactly. And that's what it's all about.
Carrie Gillam, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. The book is The Monsanto Papers. And you can go to writersvoice.net to read more about glyphosate's devastating impacts on human health and on the environment. Next up, sea level rise and what to do about it. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? You can find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. And like us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love wherever you get your podcasts. As the globe heats up due to human-caused carbon pollution, sea levels around the world are rising at an accelerating pace. New research estimates that 200 million people will live below the sea level line by 2100. An additional 160 million will be affected by higher annual flooding due to rising ocean levels. A whole lot of people will be facing the choice: adapt somehow, or move to higher ground. How can communities evaluate and face the threat of sea level rise? That's the topic of John Englander's new book, Moving to Higher Ground, Rising Sea Level and the Path Forward. In addition to being an author, Englander is an oceanographer and an expert speaker on climate change and sea level rise. His first book, High Tide on Main Street, was a bestseller about rising sea level. Well, John Englander, welcome to Writer's Voice. I wanted to say that this book, Moving to Higher Ground, really covers new ground, I think, for a lot of readers. And before we get into some of the more long-term projections of what we need to do, tell us a little bit about the complicated contributions to sea level rise so that people can understand a little bit better what actually is causing it.
And it is confusing, surprisingly so. Global sea level has changed up and down hundreds of feet over geologic history, including over the last 10 or 20,000 years. The big determinants of global sea level is the amount of ice on land, not floating ice like icebergs, but it's the ice on Greenland and Antarctica and in the Alps and so on. The ice on land, as it melts or breaks off into new icebergs and enters the ocean, that raises sea level. There's also something called thermal expansion of seawater. Sounds technical, but as water, like most substances, when it warms, it gets slightly bigger. So that's contributed to global sea level rise. So those are the three things that add to sea level. It's melt water from land, when ice melts on land, new ice that breaks off and enters the sea, and then thermal expansion of seawater. Those are the three things that affect global sea level. But surprisingly, sea level moves up and down about 400 feet with the ice age cycles because of those three processes.
And what's different about this time?
Well, there's two things that are different about this time. One is that we've been fooled because for the last 6,000 years, which is essentially recorded human history, civilization, sea level's been pretty stable. And the reason is because we'd left the 20,000 year roughly period of sea level rising as the planet naturally warmed from the last ice age, and almost certainly would have been entering the 80,000 year cooling period. We were into the stable period between the natural warming cycle and the cooling cycle that we think of as the ice ages. And during that interim between the up phase of sea level and the down phase, sea level was bent, turning the corner and seemed kind of stable. And that really guided human civilization, if you will, that sea level doesn't change a whole lot. The other thing that's happened that's distorted things is that we are now in a super warming period because, as you and your listeners know, climate change is quite real. The planet's warmer, ice is melting, weather patterns are changing. And so we're in this new super warming era that really is without precedent in human civilization.
Yeah, and you say that sea level rise is baked in, you know, that even if we were to stop putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere tomorrow, that the sea level rise would continue to go up. There is some recent research that says that if we did stop, you know, tomorrow or then the next, you know, basically 20 to 30 years, we could bring global temperatures down. We could normalize them more quickly than we had previously thought. But sea level rise would continue to go up?
Yes, it would. And that's surprising and perhaps unfortunate, but it's a fairly simple fact. Most of the studies you've read that talk about if we can slow the warming, if we can slow the greenhouse gases getting higher in the atmosphere or the level of greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide, increasing, we can slow the warming. That's true. But the simplest demonstration is if you put a pot of water on the stove and put a large quantity of ice in it and turned up the heat on the stove, of course, the ice would melt quicker. If you turn the heat down, it would melt slower. And if you turn the heat off, eventually the melting would stop. But there's a lag time because you've heated the water. And we've heated the oceans 1 degree Celsius since the industrial era. That's about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And all of the discussion these days is, can we slow the warming so that we stop the warming at an additional degree Celsius, almost another 2 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the discussion. But what that ignores is that even if we stop the warming today, because we've already warmed the oceans 1 degree, there's going to be less ice on Antarctica and Greenland. That means sea level will be higher.
You say that the impact of sea level rise, it will not only continue, but that it is likely going to be far worse than most can imagine. The current IPCC estimate is 6 feet by 2100, but you say that's an underestimate. Why is that?
Okay, the current IPCC estimate that's usually quoted is not 6 feet by 2100. It's actually just under 3 feet, 32 inches. And the discrepancy or the confusion is that they don't know how to quantify what could be contributed by Antarctica's melting in the next 80 years. And the reason is because it's melting faster and faster, and there's 185 feet of potential sea level locked up in Antarctica. So even if only 5% melts, that's like 9 feet of sea level rise. And we can't quite fine tune those projections of the models for the same reason we can't fine tune the pandemic death projections that's happening with the COVID virus. Models are great to look at interrelationships and possibilities, but they don't predict. They give us diverse projections with many inputs. What's happening now is that we're discussing ways to slow the warming, but the effects of that will not quickly translate to slowing the melting in Antarctica and Greenland.
So what's your best estimate for what we're looking at by 2100?
I think we're looking at 5 to 10 feet of sea level rise. That sounds like a broad stroke, and certainly it is, but it's about 5% of the ice melting on Greenland and Antarctica. And given the accelerating pace of melting on Greenland and Antarctica, I think that's the right thing to plan for. So if somebody wants to be more conservative, if they're designing a new house that they want to leave to their grandchildren to enjoy, 10 feet is probably a good metric. If they're 80 years old and just want to enjoy that house for the next 5 or 10 years, you know, sea level is not going to change much, frankly.
You know, that's so interesting that I said 6 feet. I participated in, you know, local community charrettes here on sea level rise. I live in East Hampton, New York, a coastal community, which is very concerned about this. And they were talking about 6 feet as being a maximum, which is interesting. And to me, I was thinking, that's not enough. I've even seen estimates as high as 21 feet, which may be way out of line. But another concern I've had is, you know, this is not necessarily a continuous gradual process. And that's something you also address in this book, Moving to Higher Ground, John Englander.
Yes. Sea level rise is not smooth and linear. What's really confusing is at the current time, even though it's been getting faster, it's still only about a quarter of an inch a year. 6 millimeters, which seems negligible, and compared to storm waves and high tides and heavy rainfall and flooding, it is. The problem is it's like a drip filling the bucket, and it's cumulative and it won't go down. So it's an entirely different phenomenon than the flooding we see or the coastal erosion. And in fact, all of those things are confused with sea level rise. But sea level rise is that drip, drip, drip filling the bucket, and the drip's getting faster. Last century, sea level rose less than 2 millimeters a year. Now it's almost six. It's almost tripled, even though we don't tend to think in metric in the United States. But the rate of sea level rise has effectively tripled in 100 years. But it's the acceleration. So it's like the pandemic again. We can look at curves and we can look at projections, but we know they're subject to change suddenly. And if the pandemic accelerates, we can get, you know, a terrible surprise with the illness and deaths even. There's a parallel with sea level rise. As the rate changes, it will surprise us. And it can happen relatively abruptly. However, not near as abrupt as a storm or hurricane or even a sudden king tide coming to town and flooding things. So we need to separate coastal erosion, which is a natural process that happens quickly during a storm, and then the flooding that happens during a king tide or heavy rainfall and runoff, sea level rise is totally different. It's the drip filling the bucket that gets higher and higher and is accelerating. It will surprise us in about 20 or 30 years.
Well, and you point out that it's not just a risk for coastal residents, but anybody who lives in the floodplain, places like Washington, D.C.
That's right. I mean, there's 10,000 coastal cities we should think of. We tend to think of Miami or East Hampton or San Francisco or Boston or Annapolis or New Orleans. It's 10,000 coastal cities, from London to Copenhagen, from Singapore to Shanghai, from Mumbai to Calcutta to Bangladesh. It's every coastal community. And as you say, it goes up coastal rivers. So places we don't think of, like Washington, D.C., like London, like Sacramento, California, are on tidal rivers, and they're vulnerable to sea level rise.
Yeah. So let's now move to what we can do about it. For one thing, I'd like you to talk about insurance, because you say that insurance, the whole insurance industry, may actually be increasing our risk, and we need to fix that. So what's wrong with the current situation, and what do we need to do?
Insurance is, in every case, except for life insurance, is a one-year policy on something happening. And in the next year, sea level rise isn't going to be an inch. So the chance of flooding relating to sea level rise during the next insurance policy that any of us buys is almost zero. But if you look ahead 10 years or 20 years, and certainly by 30 years, sea level rise is going to change not only flooding as a temporary event, sea level rise is going to permanently flood many properties. So we have a mismatch between a one-year insurance policy and the decades over which sea level rise will happen, pushing the shoreline inland and permanently submerging properties. So the insurance industry really needs to rethink some things. And some of this will fall to governments to require insurance policies to have some provision for putting money into a 10 or 20 or 30 year fund, because the natural or the normal way that insurance is written, as I say, is year to year and doesn't really care what happens 20 years from now. But sea level rise can't be a problem during the next 12 months of the policy. So that's going to take governmental requirement to set aside adequate reserves and exposure. Tail risk is sometimes the term that's used to balance between what the flooding that can happen next year versus what could happen over 20 to 30 years gradually.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with sea level rise expert John Englander about his new book, Moving to Higher Ground. It's a sequel to his bestseller, High Tide on Main Street. You know, one issue, too, is, I mean, where I live in East Hampton, it can be difficult to get insurance. You know, companies like Allstate no longer insure homes here. And I've been kind of assuming that, you know, property values are going to be drastically affected by sea level rise in a community like this or any community that's vulnerable. But you also see some reason for hope. So give us the glass half full, glass half empty aspect of this.
If we see the picture clearly of what's happening and we can distinguish between the flood events from a hurricane or something that could happen next week, or the high tide that we may know will happen at a certain date in a certain location to a certain height because it's predictable by the tide tables, and that sea level rise is different. If we begin to understand that, we can both comprehend it and we can plan for it, but it's a new reality. We have not seen sea level being higher than present in all of human civilization. In fact, in almost all of human history, the last time sea level was higher was 122,000 years ago, when it reached 25 feet higher than present. So the first thing is to start with knowledge. And I make the metaphor in Moving to Higher Ground that we can see this somewhat like our lives. We know we're going to get older and eventually we're going to die. But there's rebirth, renewal, there's next generations, and we prepare for that. And we pass things down, both intellectually and physically, if you will. Well, the clarity that sea level rise will continue, that it will eventually, over centuries, follow the path that last happened more than 100,000 years ago, really can give us a glass half full rather than half empty. because sea level rise is not going to be disastrous in the next few years. But 30 years from now, sea level will be higher. It could be a foot or two higher. With that clarity, we will design different, and it becomes a great opportunity. The idea that we now have the knowledge that sea level will be several feet higher and more if we don't slow the warming of the planet actually gives us a vision to the future and allows us to plan. We can begin planning now. That becomes an opportunity. It means we have to design differently. It may affect our investments. It will affect our engineering, our architecture, legal issues, what we finance, because we finance things commonly for 30 years. And within 30 years, sea level could be significantly higher. So it affects everything.
A lot of folks say we are going to have to retreat from the coasts. You actually outlined some ways in which, you know, yes, that will be true for some people in some areas, but that there may be ways to adapt to that. Talk about the psychology, the psychological impact of this, and how people can wrap their minds around solutions for this. Because as soon as you talk about coastal retreat, I know from personal experience, people get very angry and are in total denial. So how do we deal with the psychology, and what kind of hope can we give people who do live in areas that are at risk?
We do get angry about this, and we are attached to places. We're attached to people. We're attached to things, assets that we like, whether it be artwork, and we're attached to places. Psychologists actually identify that place attachment. The coastline is determined by the height of the ocean. The fact that it's been fairly stable for 6,000 years, which just happens to be recorded human civilization. If you think that the Christian era goes back 2,000 years and you get back to the Old Testament days and the Chinese, Hebrew, and Mayan calendars get us back about 5,000 years. But recorded human history, 6,000 or 8,000 years. We don't think like that normally. But just 10,000 years ago, sea level was rising at 15 feet a century. 10,000 years ago, the Great Lakes were formed. Before that, they didn't exist. They were under ice. And as the last glaciers retreated, they made some nick marks, which then filled with water. They became the Great Lakes 10,000 years ago. At the same time, Long Island, where you are, and Cape Cod were formed by the remnants of the glaciers retreating. So we think of landforms as permanent, but in recent geologic history, landforms have changed dramatically. But emotionally, we have trouble with that. And intellectually, we didn't know that until the last century or two.
So what do we do about it? Are you telling me now I'm just going to have to leave Long Island? Because that's certainly something I think about. Or are there ways, in fact, that we can adapt to what's happening?
Well, both. If you're going to live another 100 years, you are going to relocate. Okay. If in the next 10 years you ask me if you have to move because of sea level rise, I would say no. I would say that if you're renovating your house, you should pay attention to how high it is above sea level, regardless of how far it is from the shoreline. And you should, if you have the opportunity, increase your height above water level the next time you do a renovation, or close a window opening in the basement or something like that. We need to think about sea level rising higher, which will affect the height during stormy weather, during king tides, heavy rainfall and runoff. While we want to procrastinate and do nothing, we want to live the life, you know, that we remember from the last 10 years. The truth is, the clarity that sea level is going to rise faster and faster, eventually becoming an inch a year and then inches a year by the end of the century, is an opportunity to plan in advance. We will move inland as sea level moves higher. Now, we may put some things on floats, whether it be houseboats or live on ships or on pilings, or do different clever design things to accommodate sea level rise. When sea level is 10 feet higher, whether it's this century or next, the coastline will be inland. There are some things we can do to engineer and design, both architecturally and pure engineering, and ways to raise structures. All of those things we'll figure out. But there are going to be a lot of places that are permanently underwater. We need to wake up to that reality.
So if you had one thing that you felt was needed to be done, not by individuals, but by government, by states, cities, and local communities, even the federal government, if we can get past the gridlock, what would that be?
It's a great question and a really important one. The most important thing that our governments can do all over the world is to recognize that sea level is going to be several meters, 5 or 10 feet higher. And we need to think of building codes differently. Right now, in essentially every community in the world, architects build to something called the finished floor elevation, what they call FFE. It's what's required in terms of your height in reference to sea level. And it might be 3 feet above sea level. It might be 3.5 feet, whatever it is in a different community. We need to not only raise that, but we need to think in a different way. We need to think short, medium, and long term. So that if I was in charge of planning for whether it be the city of Fort Lauderdale or Florida or the United States or the world, I would say, think of the next decade or two as short term. Think of 30 years from now as medium term. And think 100 years from now, the year 2120 is long term. And begin to specify increases in elevation requirements, that finished floor elevation, over 100 years. So I might say, in the next 20 years, we're going to raise the finished floor elevation a foot. For 30 years out, it's going to be 4 feet. And for anything that needs to, that is planned to be in existence for 100 years from now, like infrastructure, like buildings and bridges, and actually most buildings today are designed to last 100 years, plan for 3 meters, 10 feet of sea level rise. If we begin to approach this, the required code for buildings and infrastructure, looking out short, medium, and long term, we will make the adaptation. But right now, we always think of short term.
Well, that's great. And there are many more ideas in your terrific book, Moving to Higher Ground, Rising Sea Level, and the Path Forward. John Englander, it has just been such a pleasure to talk with you about this very crucial topic for ourselves and for our children and grandchildren. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Francesca, for spreading the awareness.
Find links to John Englander's blog, Sea Level Rise Now, at writersvoice.net. Coming up next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Judy Battalion about the thrilling story of the Jewish women who fought the Nazis in the Polish underground. We also talk with author Lissa Evans about her new novel, V for Victory. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.